Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe, a podcast where you'll get to learn from the experts in the field of sex, love, and relationships. The mission of the Sex Talk Cafe is to normalize the conversation on sexuality while building a bridge between the sexual and spiritual. I'm your host, Susan Morgan Taylor. I'm a holistic sex therapist, intuitive coach, and specialist in women's sexuality and feminine spirituality. I'm the founder and CEO of the Pathway to Pleasure Collective, where I help women and couples around the world restore intimacy, save their relationship, and get back to love without feeling like they have to sacrifice themselves just to keep their partner happy. Thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe. I'm very excited about today's guest, Dr. Stephen Radowitz, who is the Chief Medical Officer and co-founder of Nushama, a psychedelic wellness center. Starting his career in New York during the peak of the opioid and AIDS crisis, Dr. Stephen Radowitz has a wealth of experience seeing the effects of trauma and addiction can have on our physical health. He believes psychedelic medicine's framework of neuroscience, mystical experience, and integration therapy is the future of mental wellness, and current solutions often fall short. I really agree. I'm so excited to talk about that. Short of treating symptoms without addressing underlying issues. We're going to talk about that today. I'm so excited to get into that with you, Dr. Radowitz. Dr. Radowitz has a passion for preventive medicine, getting to the root of a health problem before it manifests. In contrast to traditional medicine, he views psychedelics as powerful tools to help us become aware of the origin of imbalance and guide us towards wholeness, health, and well-being, and healing from within. Dr. Radowitz, welcome so much.
Wow. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you so much. And welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, I think this is just a really exciting topic and certainly one that is very timely. I think these types of approaches and treatments to mental health and other types of conditions are really, I think its time has come, and I think the public is becoming more and more aware of them. And I would love if maybe you could just briefly explain just a little bit, what do you do at Nushama? What types of services do you offer in terms of the psychedelic wellness, and what types of issues do you treat?
Yeah, so generally we treat here at Nushama, we use IV ketamine infusions in a set protocol based on the best studies out there to treat treatment-resistant depression, treatment-resistant anxiety disorders, general anxiety disorders, PTSD, addiction care. So we have incredible results with addiction. We have a separate separate program for addiction, alcohol use disorder, and various other addictions, from sex addiction to opiates to social media addiction. We treat eating disorders. We've had really good response with eating disorders. So generally treatment-resistant mood disorders.
Okay, I love this. And I am really curious to know about the use of ketamine with addictions, because I think there is and I don't know if this is true or not, there are some people that believe that it's not good to use for addictions because people are addicted. They have an addiction problem. So is there any risk of getting addicted to the treatment when you use ketamine?
Absolutely. So ketamine, you know, and used it, the dose, it's a very interesting substance. So the route of administration, the dose you use, and how fast it's infused even, can have incredibly it's almost like a different drug at different doses and different ways of administering it. So when used in smaller doses, like you hear out in more recreational settings where people inhale it or whatnot, you get a big burst of it and then it just drops. It's a very short acting drug, so they get a little bit of a high. So it affects different neurotransmitters also with different doses. So it's very different when you use it the way we're using it in IV and in a clinical, in a set clinical setting with proper, you know, with proper medical care and with proper intentions. It is a much different experience. It's more of a psychedelic experience. It's not always pleasant. So we go beyond just the sort of pleasantness, the euphoric effects, and we get into a much deeper, more what we call ego dissociative effects that are very different and that none of our patients have become addicted to it, and you wouldn't become addicted to use in that setting. So
yeah, it makes a lot of sense, because I imagine when you're using it recreationally, kind of the method of ingestion, how you take it, it can really spike the dopamine levels in the brain really rapidly, I'm assuming, and that's kind of part of the addiction cycle for some individuals. kind of what's happening.
The reason you take it affects, even like their intentions of going into it. What am I going into it for? Am I using it just to get high and go and have a party? That effect, the intention itself affects the dopamine levels. Where when you're coming in to treat a sort of a mood disorder, it's very different. It's very, very different the way it affects our, those receptors in the brain.
Yeah. And I'm curious because you said that it's not always pleasant. So could you just speak a little bit more about that? Because I think it's so common that we hear about all the great benefits of ketamine and psychedelic therapy, but there, you know, with any kind of intervention, there's always a potential risk or a potential downside. And I'm really curious about what you've seen in your practice and how do you mitigate that?
Yeah. So we mitigate, when you go into these sessions, we have a lot of supports here. So not only clinical support, I'm a medical doctor, but also, and we have psychiatric nurse practitioners, but we also have therapists, integration coaches, life coaches, who help people go, when they go into these experiences, they go in with a proper intention and they feel safe going into it. The experiences, again, the dose is different. Psychedelics, even mushrooms, or other types of psychedelic, ayahuasca, or you hear about ibogaine, things, they're not always euphoric experiences by any means. It's really a deep dive into the self. So when you start to sort of, they're all like very similar in that they sort of, it's almost like a chemical key to the ego, to the mind, the way we process the world. And when we start to take that offline, you get a deeper sort of sense, a different perspective of the way we see the world. But, you know, when people, especially with past traumas or past issues in their life, when you start to take the ego offline, this brain offline, it doesn't like it. It's saying, hey, this is not safe. What are you doing? You're taking me offline. And when you start to see these things that are unusual and you don't feel safe, it can be uncomfortable. So the way we mitigate is we have a lot of support. So when people go into those difficult experiences, we help them support. Even a difficult experience we find can be the most clinically beneficial. So we teach us when you're having, so in the journeys, you know, you might have a perception of unsafety, a perception of darkness, fear. It's just the unknown. It's not, but they're lying in a chair with an eye mask and nice earphones, very comfortable, the whole medical team around them, and they're safe. So any real, perception of unsafety is just a perception. Yeah. So when they learn that, we teach the brain that actually, I know you felt unsafe, but you really were safe. So that's part of the process of trying to help people through some of the events and traumatic events from their past to learn that where they are currently, what happened to them when they were 5 years old or as a child or even a year ago, right now they're safe.
So that makes a lot of sense. And I'm curious in your approach, it was my understanding that with these types of approaches, usually there is a therapist or a team like next to the person, like someone that can even guide them through some of these like people that have been there themselves. They've maybe tried the ketamine or, you know, had experience with that can then help somebody who's going through a rough patch so that it's a therapeutic experience rather than another re-traumatizing experience. Is that how you work at your clinic where you actually have somebody like beside the person while they're doing their journey?
Yeah, no. So we don't believe in this. So the journey is very different than some other like psilocybin. It's a 60-minute experience. Okay. I'm asking a very immersive experience. And they're going on the journeys within themselves, you know. So a lot of it is just turning off. So we do not talk to anyone during. So you wouldn't be able to speak too much during it. There's different ways. I'll start with, there's two different ways of doing ketamine. So there is ketamine assisted therapy, which we do here. So a higher dose, psychedelic dosing of ketamine. Inward experience, we prepare them before, we integrate with them after the experience.
Okay.
If you're having a difficult time during it, we do come in and we help them through it, but it's more supportive. And really that's finding the answers within. Then there's ketamine assisted psychotherapy where they use low doses, maybe in a lozenge form or a nasal spray where they use low dose. It's called a psycholytic dose where they're able to converse. So it decreases it makes them feel a little bit safer, and there's psychotherapy done while under the influence of the ketamine. We don't do it that way. I have issues that, you know, that could work for some people, but there could be harm also if you don't have the right therapist doing it and you're opening yourself up and you're under the influence and in a suggestible state.
Yeah.
Could be risky, and I have issues. So again, it depends on the therapist. You have to be careful who you're allowing into that space while you're under the influence of any drug like that. So I think it's safer, and we're having really, really good results in the current form. So we do support, we go in and we check on people, but really it's an inward experience and it's worked really well for our members here.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute, but I'm also curious if somebody did have maybe an experience that wasn't so great and they didn't feel that support, or it wasn't maybe done in a way like how you do it, you know, with as much support. How would you suggest, what would that person do to advocate more for themselves, either in the moment or even afterwards? What kind of follow-up care do you think somebody might need from an experience like that?
I mean, I think you have to have people around you that understand the medicine, that could reframe anything. I think it's like in life, you know, some of the most difficult periods in life could, if properly reframed and we can learn from it and grow, we have an opportunity to grow from those experiences and move on and gain some wisdom. Same thing with a very difficult psychedelic experience. Number one, everybody in our center has gone through the experiences. So we've taken the ketamine at various doses and we know what it's like. So we know what a difficult experience is. Most of the difficult experiences are not necessarily anything specific. In the journey, you know, it's other, very otherworldly. So you're not, you can't really make sense of what comes up. So it does, rarely will it reach what's called a bad experience or a difficult experience under ketamine. It's more of like this feeling like I just witnessed something that's otherworldly and I start to question this reality a little bit. But, you know, when you come back, that all goes away. There's nowhere to store that in our current memory, in our current brain. So it's rarely, we feel the emotions, the fear of the unknown, but there's no memory to attach it to because it just dissolves. So it's rare that someone will have a traumatic experience that's going to, or re-traumatizing experience or a new traumatic experience from a difficult journey. That being said, there are some people with very deep trauma, like wartime trauma, things like that, that could, it's very rare, but it can happen where they where they get exposed to it again. But we support that support afterwards. We can turn that difficult re-exposure into something very, very, to reframe it in a way that we actually help them through and let go of that trauma. And
got
that's
it.
What we're doing. So.
Cool. Well, let's kind of loop this conversation a little bit towards sex therapy and couples work. And maybe we can just start with couples work because you do these approaches with couples as well. Is that correct? You use the ketamine therapy for couples?
Yeah. So we use the ketamine with couples. We usually, generally, they're not in the same room together. They're separate. So we've done both. So we have done, and we've worked with some sex therapists actually here at our center who've done groups. They've done a group, not just with a couple, but a group of people, different couples or individuals who are having problems in relationships to help them open. And so yes, we do work with that. And but I think the most important thing is like in a couple is like the individual people have their own issues that they bring into the relationship.
Yeah.
And sometimes when we start to work on those issues and erode and process those issues, then you come into that relationship with a healthier mindset. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, yeah, I'm sure you know, you see that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the approach you're saying is they do the journeys usually individually,
right,
and then they'll come into maybe working with a therapist to integrate as a couple.
A couples therapist, integrate the experience. So people have their own issues. And sometimes we have to work on those things. Sometimes the issues and the trauma could be intra-couple. So it could have been something that happened during the relationship, like infidelity or some other issue that should be done to, you know, maybe sometimes it does help. But often it's merely having them work separately and then bringing them together to integrate the experience. That's what I found very helpful.
Nice. Well, you hear this term a lot with the psychedelic work called set and setting. And I'm kind of curious if you could explain what that means for our listeners.
Yeah. So set refers to mindset. So what is your mindset? What's your intention going into the experience? What do you want? You know, it's important to know what you want from it. So, you know, it's one thing, like you say, like in a recreational setting, if I'm just going to do ketamine or MDMA or psilocybin and go and have party, go to a party and just, you know, try and, get high, or you're going to go into it and you're going to bring like, I want to work on myself. There's something, this thing that's been working, bothering me, a relationship I had, some issue in my relationship that's really been, you know, stuck with me, or a problem I had with my child or my parent, or, and that you bring that into the experience. So that's the set, it's the mindset of what you want to work on. And then the setting is the environment, it's having a safe place to go and explore. So when you go into these experiences, you have to feel safe. you're not going to be able to go for that deep dive and really let go into the experience if you don't feel safe. So having a safe setting, so the environment itself, having a nice room and a place that feels comfortable and clean and safe, you know, we have a chair and the music and all that. And then also the people around you, you have the integration coaches, to the doctors, to the clinical staff, that they're all there to comfort you and you feel safe, like, okay, I'm safe here. I could really let go. So that's what we refer to as setting, set and setting. Yeah.
It.
And it's just as important as the medicine you use, more important. I shouldn't say just, much more important. The medicine is just the catalyst. The music, all these other things that are part of that environment is essential, I think, to having a good and a productive and a clinically beneficial experience.
Yeah, and I think what you're speaking to is this holistic approach versus, you know, I think in our culture, we really tend to have this idea of it's just that I call it like the active ingredient theory, which mm-hmm. our whole medical system is founded on, right? And it says so much, I think, about the belief system of our culture in general. But when really there's so many other factors that are actually influencing the experience that someone's having in their own health and healing and in their own creation of disease and imbalance and illness. And I'm wondering if that resonates with you, if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think our consciousness and what we bring, also the mindset, the setting that we bring into it is our belief. Our belief is so important. You know, when you go into a psychedelic, you have to, you have to meet it somewhere. The medicine itself is just a catalyst, even an antibiotic. I'm an internist also. So people come to me and they have a virus. I know they have a virus and I'm sick and they really want that antibiotic. I'm like, you don't need the antibiotic. You're going to be fine without it. You're healthy. You're sick. You just let it process. Your body, your immune system will take care of it. No, I need the antibiotic. I want my Z-Pack. Once in a while I succumb and I'll give them their Z-Pack. And the next day they call me, oh, I'm feeling much better. You see, it worked. Even if it would never work that quickly, but their belief in the antibiotic, it's so important. They believed in the antibiotic and it worked, you know, and they felt bad the next day. Same thing with the psychedelic, same thing with everything in life. It's not the substance. It's just the substance is the catalyst. It's a tool, but it's not a treatment.
Well, do you think we'll ever get to a point where we don't really need the actual substance, where you've got the whole thing happening and maybe it's just a sugar pill?
Absolutely. If I can give more sugar pills, I bet you that an infusion of ketamine. And I do believe that a lot of it is, I mean, the placebo effect, we don't realize the placebo effect is a huge part of the treatment. When they do medical studies, the placebo effect always has a positive effect from doing nothing. I mean, what does that tell us? And sometimes, often, if you look at some of these studies that we use to approve drugs, the placebo effect and the drug effect are almost identical, are very close.
Especially, I think, in psychotropic meds for depression, the SSRIs, I think that's really true. Am I correct? What the research
says? Very much. There's books on this that sometimes, some of them, actually in some studies that they pushed to the side, the placebo did better than the drug because the drug has side effects.
Yeah.
You know, so absolutely. I think, and even with ketamine, I mean, ketamine is an experience. Okay, you can't deny you have an experience. It's the experience, not the drug. Okay, there's a neuroplastic process and you can go into all what it does to our neurotransmitters. But in the end, it's really our change of perspective and our belief in it. And then the work you do afterwards, everyone asks, how long does this last? Well, what work are you going to put into it? What's your belief? That's very, very, very important. Very important. Yeah.
Part of that placebo effect also is maybe on one, I have a lot of theories about placebo effect actually. On one level, even just the knowing that you're doing something about it can have a healing effect. So even if you're just taking a sugar pill, you don't know it's a sugar pill, you think that you're doing something about your condition, and therefore, and then you have people also paying attention to you and showing you care and attention. Like, so that in and of itself is healing. And then I have a whole theory too about the morphogenic field and the collective consciousness and, you know, where's the placebo effect held in that? And are we just like tapping into that and like downloading that? And, you know, that might be a little too trippy for today's conversation.
But it's interesting you mentioned that because there's studies on that exact what you just said. And you know, the belief, the placebo effect doesn't just go into the sugar pill, but the color of the pill, actually the way it's given. So the more invasive the the procedure or the treatment, the more likely they are to believe. The placebo effect gets stronger as it gets. So, you know, taking a pill versus like if or an IV, the IV is more likely to have a better placebo effect than the pill. And the and what's even crazy when you talk about the the belief in the doctor, the placebo effect goes into the doctor. So if the doctor or the nurse or the whoever is giving you the treatment or the therapist or whoever it is, whoever's giving you the treatment, if they believe in it, it's more likely to work. So yeah. The placebo is also for the person providing you with the service.
Absolutely. I used to do a lot of energy healing work. And one of the things I really notice, it's the belief of the actual healer that if you're not aligned, like it's a co-creative thing that's happening. And it's so much more complex than this active ingredient theory. Let's find the one thing that, you know, fixes the problem. It just doesn't work that way. There's so much more complexity to healing. Really curious if you feel comfortable to share, just do you have your own personal story, I'm sure, in your journey of just kind of how you got into this? And was there anything notable that you'd like to share with our listeners about how you got into psychedelic work?
Yeah. I mean, I think I got into it many years ago. It started off not with necessarily a substance, but a patient of mine who gave me a book on Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, like Jewish. So it was like mystical. And I like read it, and he wasn't Jewish. And he's like, I don't know why, it just came to me, you know, from this weird. And I read this book and I was just like, oh my God, this is so smart. And it was like sort of scientific, but yet spiritual, and sort of a good merge of the two. And I started to really get into it on read. And I started to sort of bring some of that into my medical. I was an internist, so I wasn't even in psych. I'm not a psychiatrist. And I really got into that. And I started talking to people more about spirituality and meditation and yoga and all these things together with, you know, medicine, and started to see through some of, you know, people's medical issues that there was actually something much deeper. Maybe on a more spiritual aspect. So that was my first, like, that was really my real psychedelic experience. I started to see the world from a different perspective. And then years later, my partner had, husband had issues with headaches after we had our first son, our first child was born, and terrible headaches every day. And had, you know, we couldn't figure it out. We had sinus surgery, acupuncture, medications, everything. Nothing really took it away. And someone mentioned going on a journey, like a psychedelic journey. And it took us about a year. Never did drugs before. Never did psychedelics before. And so we decided to go on this journey, went together. And it was very formal. And they used, I think it was MDMA and psilocybin, eye mask, music. It was very controlled with integration before and after. And after, in the first journey, it was shown exactly where the trauma was, where the headaches were coming from, and the headaches completely went away. I'm like, whoa,
my gosh.
And that together with the numbers, we started exploring it more and getting, you know, started exploring that different types of psychedelics and seeing the power. I read I don't know if anyone's ever read this book, How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. It's a great book. I was really interested in the psychedelics. He was a New York Times writer. He actually worked on with food, like the whole food industry, did a lot of writing books about that, and then went and explored psychedelics from a very objective and scientific point of view, and went through the journeys himself as well. So anyways, I saw the power in this, and over COVID, someone I knew came to me and said, hey, I'm thinking of opening up a psychedelic wellness center using ketamine, which is legal. And there's amazing studies showing its benefit. And I knew there was going to be a big issue after COVID with mental health issues. So I said, okay, I started part-time. I was still in my medical practice, and I saw how well it was working. I'm like, oh my God, this stuff is better than I expected. It's working much better than I expected. And I went full-time, and that's how I got into it.
Oh, that's amazing. And you also had mentioned when I talked to you earlier, before we got on here, that this has impacted your own relationship in a positive way. And since we're here on Sex Talk Cafe, I want to see, maybe can we tie, if you're comfortable sharing, maybe how this has impacted your own life and your own intimate relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the spirituality and also the psychedelics, it just makes you more open, more present. That's your mind. You're less likely to judge. You know, everyone comes into relationships with different issues, personal issues sometimes that we haven't really processed ourselves. It helped us really process our own issues. So when we're in the relationship, we're much more open, more present with each other, sensuality, sexuality, the way we see it, moving away from, like, you know, using anything external, like pornography, things like just didn't seem to take you away from relationships, you know, and it really brought us into something to be more not only sexual but sensual and more aligned emotionally.
Yeah.
That really helped. And doing it with my partner and going on the spiritual journey together really was.
That's really bonding, I bet.
Really bonding, really bonding. Much more open, you know, trying to keep a peaceful.
And I think too, because, you know, if there's anxiety or trauma, and all of us have some version of trauma, not necessarily big T, but little T traumas that happen over time, you know, those things over time can really lead to the challenge in accessing pleasure and connection. If there's anxiety or fear of rejection or judgment, or an inability to access what's called like that direct route of pleasure, like through the nerve endings of the skin up to the brain, like so many things can happen to us over a lifespan that cause us just to kind of pull away from that innate desire to reach out and connect through touch and to allow our bodies to drop into pleasure. So I can imagine that the ketamine, because it can address so many different kinds of issues, anxiety and trauma being one of them, that alone can really have a healing effect on two individuals who are in a relationship where there could be more openness and more connection. And maybe some of those issues just aren't even there anymore after the ketamine. And maybe some of them need a little more work or support or, you know, work through therapy. But I would imagine that some things maybe even just sort of dissolve and aren't even an issue anymore. Have you found that to be the case?
Absolutely. That's the whole point of it. Just to be more present. Let's judge a change in perspective. You know, we see the world through what happened to us as we, you know, as we our journey throughout our life as children. So if we, you know, if our parents, you know, maybe got divorced, or maybe there was infidelity in their relationship, or maybe there was sexual trauma or sexual abuse. So we, you know, we don't feel trusted. We don't feel there's issues with abandonment. You know, obviously we bring that into a relationship, but when we help process some of those issues and know that we're safe, then we're more likely to be open, you know, emotionally, sensually, you know, and sexually. But if we don't do those things and we bring that in, we don't trust. We see the partner as, you know, through the eyes of that unsafe child.
Absolutely. You know?
But we are safe now. And often our partner is not a risk, so if we can help process some of that, work on some of that, let go of some of that, we can be much more, we can see our partner and our loved one from where we are, from a perspective of where we are today and what we so choose.
Let me ask more about that, because, you know, especially when there's trauma, and especially developmental trauma, where it's been just sort of consistent over extended period of times over the lifespan, the brain, my understanding is, it actually, you get stuck in that limbic system, which is the hindbrain, the reptilian brain, and in lack of development sometimes of the access to that prefrontal cortex where we can take a perspective where empathy happens. And so if somebody is in overdrive in that hindbrain and they do ketamine, how does that help them sort of rewire or eventually bring that prefrontal cortex online so that you can have more of what you're speaking to, where you're not just caught in that hypervigilant loop?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's the way the brain's, I call the brain like sort of an AI. It's an organic computer, a very sophisticated computer that's here to make sure we survive. It's responsible for our existence, you know, and it does so by, you know, tries to perceive or predict what's in front of me, is it safe or not, and how to respond or react if it's an emergency. And so it gets programmed over the years, you know, through these algorithms, through our experiences. So if something happened to me that was unsafe as a child, that gets programmed, the memory of that unsafe event gets put into my memory, gets wired to an emotion that we felt at the time. So next time I see something, we see anything that even looks like it or pattern-wise, we start to see people through that lens, and we get triggered. So anything triggers me, like a parent, someone abusing a child, either physically or physically, anyone that looks, any adult could, any situation could trigger that emotion and get me to recluse, go into a fight or flight mode and safety and retract and, you know, go back into safety. But that's not true. Like, those old programs are not valid anymore. So what the ketamine does is it opens up the wiring with this default mode network, these connections between my memories and my emotions. It opens up the wiring and allows it to this is the neuroplastic process. So the connections are not as intense and allows me to choose. So when I don't get, I don't get triggered. So when an event that looked like something like that doesn't trigger me like it did in the past. So I have a little bit of time to, number one, to determine how do I want to see this situation in front of me, this person in front of me, this, and how do I want to respond rather than reacting from a place of unsafety. So it's, that's the whole processing that happens through therapy. So therapy is important. There's all types of techniques and trauma techniques that we can work on. But over years, people eventually, it's a very intellectual process, therapy. Yeah. Eventually, what ketamine does and what psychedelics do is it takes all that intellect and brings it into your heart. It allows you to let go. Okay, I know it. Now I can feel it. It allows you to feel it.
Like that cathartic experience of release of that trapped energy of emotion that's in the body that we know leads to chronic illness. And
right. And then it's the prefrontal. And what's the prefrontal cortex? It's just all, that's what makes us human. It's interesting. The prefrontal cortex is all about inhibition. It's all negative things that inhibit the animalistic, the animalistic part of ourselves. That this desire for survival comes from you know, it comes from the hindbrain. The front brain is all about turning that off a little bit and letting me just be in the present in a place of safety. But it, you know, we don't just come here to survive. We come here to live, have meaning and purpose and joy and happiness. That's the soulful part of ourselves. That's the innate levity of life that we need. We need both in this world. We have to be safe, but we also have to live. And that's the grace, and finding that balance is so important. And our emotions are there to help guide us. When we're out of alignment, we feel the emotions. So it tells us that, you know, maybe I'm too much in my head, too much into the existence. I need a little balance. I need to bring back that living, that life, that presence. And hopefully we get back into alignment. And that's, psychedelics are also to help open all that up. And so I call it a recalibration a process. Cool for recalibration.
The brain and the associations that we have between feeling, thought, and, you know, the visual cortex being stimulated by something, or even just, you know, the associations between feelings and how that can affect us. So on your website, you say 75% of your participants in this therapy have clinically meaningful improvements. And I want to educate our audience, because if anyone's out there looking for a clinic, they might have different claims. And I'm curious if you could talk about, what does that actually mean? Clinically meaningful.
Where do we get these numbers from? So we check out. Yeah. So we everyone before they start treatment and at various times, one point midway, and then at the end after treatment, we administer these questionnaires: PHQ-9s for depression, GAD-7s, this GAD-7 for general anxiety, this one PCL for trauma, various other ones, we have ones for eating disorder. So we monitor some numbers. So those are more, you know, sort of objective findings, and also from just interviewing people. And we've seen a significant drop. There's a, you know, statistically significant drop, and we have studies. We just actually were in the process of we just had a study approved in the Journal of Psychopharmacology.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, which is
so great. Is that 75% unique to your clinic, or is that ketamine studies in general tend to spit that number out? Because I've got another detailed question.
Yeah, so it's from our clinic. You know, it's real world. So the thing with ketamine studies, if you look at a lot of the ketamine studies, they're not really world. They're real world environment. So set and setting is not. They're just trying, in all those studies, they're just trying to show that the chemical itself, ketamine as a drug, is the effective. So they use lower doses, and there's no set and setting. There's no music. They're just giving you before and after, and then they measure test. And it's a little harsh, and they don't go up on the dose. So those numbers are not as good as what we get in our center.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because if what we're talking about, that it's this holistic integrated thing that's happening when somebody is in this healing process, and ketamine's a part of that, but there's all these other pieces, and it really would matter what clinic you go to and what approach you're taking in terms of using this type of therapy, right? I mean, that it's huge, bigger than I think people might really know. So anyone listening, you want to kind of vet that. I would think somehow. And how would somebody vet that if they're looking for a clinic to do this?
Yeah, I think it's important you ask them, you know, what's their philosophy on this? Is there integration? Do they have someone that, and you know, it could be a life coach, doesn't have to necessarily be a therapist. Always some people agree with me, although most of our you know, our integration coaches are therapists, because it's very different than therapy, but having support You know, emotional support before and after the set and setting. What's the environment? Maybe they have pictures of the, is it a nice setting, or are you going to be sitting on lying on a stretcher, in some very clinical cold room? I mean, I would not want to wake up in that. Like, it would be
No,
very.
that doesn't sound nice to me. That sounds
No,
like I get anxiety just like coming through the door.
I mean, the same thing, people use LSD, let's say recreationally, and hear like, oh my God, I had a bad trip. Well, if you're in, a setting where that's not conducive to that, and you're around a bunch of people, some other people doing it, freaking out, it can be very, very
Really
scary.
scary.
When you're under the influence of these psychedelics, it's a big deal. Like, I take it very seriously. Like, I've done it. And when after I did it, I'm like, oh my God, should I be giving people this? Like, I was like, this is a big deal, and we take it very seriously. So it's not, when you do these things, you have to be responsible with it. It's beautiful and it's amazing work. And it's, I mean, it's life-changing for most people. I would say that, close to like well over 90% of people here, it'll touch you in some way. You will walk out of here more of who you are. It doesn't change your personality in any way, but you'll walk out of here more open, more yourself, less in the thoughts, more in your heart. And like people, like I say
Well,
almost
we need
every day,
that, right, in the world, more
you do
heart-centered
it
living.
properly. But I would say, like you said, Lee, to answer your question, I think it's very important you do this in a proper setting, in a clinical setting, and not doing it at home. There's all these at-home ketamine where people can
Okay.
take mushrooms and do it in their house. I mean, it depends on your house and your environment. If you're going to be doing it in a traumatic setting, you're in an abusive relationship or something, and you're taking this ketamine and the person's next to you, that's not a very good, you're going to wake up in that. It can be very destabilizing if you don't have the
Yeah,
proper.
well, that's kind of where I was going to go there next, actually. Maybe we should just jump on that since it's up. There was another question I had about clinically meaningful, but maybe I can loop back to that since we're kind of this is opening. Traditionally, the spiritual and psychedelic realms were the domain of the shamans and the native traditional healers. And it seems like in our country, this is starting to become relegated to the medical domain. Do you see any risk in that or any detriment to that versus having it be more in the hands of the people or more holistic
Yeah,
practitioners?
I do. I think it's a big issue. I don't think most people. I don't see psychedelics as a whole separate form of medicine. It is a psycho-spiritual combination. So it's a spiritual experience, and I think the practitioners who are giving it should be comfortable helping people in that. Having such an experience. So having a psychiatrist who sees this very Cartesian, very like, this is just like sort of a drug, and it's going to be another drug. Well, that's what it'll be. And it can be very destabilizing. And we see that even with regular psychotropic medications, a lot of people don't do so well. They see that there's no investments. So I do think you have to be trained and experienced. And I think anyone giving psychedelics, the person giving you the psychedelics should have done them before. I really do. I
Gotta
mean,
be the roadman, right? You gotta know the terrain.
I almost think it's unethical not to. If you're going to put someone through one of these experiences, you have to really know what you're putting people through and respect. So it's something very different. So.
That being said, I mean, do you also feel like the people who use this approach should have already some sort of openness to spirituality? Like, can you say more about that? Is there some certain type of person for whom this is better than others?
Yes, I think it changes what I discuss. I take a very spiritual approach to it, medical and spiritual. So I don't separate. I think mystical and science is about the same. If you read about quantum physics, it's like you feel like you're reading a spiritual novel. I mean, it's crazy. So I don't think that there are two. I think we're just not that advanced yet to understand the idea of a soul or an energy that inhabits something, or a lot of this, what we call mystical, is science, it's just much more advanced than we understand right now. But I think you have to be open to that. The practitioner should be open to that. Now, the person coming in, it definitely helps, but it doesn't mean when they, but I also find that a lot of people who don't come in with a spiritual background, after they go through these experiences, are much more open to.
Suddenly they've got one.
That's sort of my goal is, some of it is opening people up to seeing the world. What's spiritual? Just seeing the world from a different perspective, from a perspective for something, you know, not necessarily in a dualistic, but more of a, you know, things could be in the same two states at the same time. Something very bad that happened to us in our life could actually be an amazing catalyst for amazing good, could open us up. We can gain so much wisdom and growth from that, and could be the best thing that ever happened to us. So being able to see things from that perspective, you know, that's where psychedelics can really help. So you don't have to come in with a, you know, belief in God or, you know, or a spiritual background or religious in any way, you know, I don't think so. But when you leave here, you'll definitely see things from a different perspective. And that's whatever you leave for. If they get a little bit of that, I think can be very helpful. Yeah. Hope that answered the question.
Well, yeah, sure. And do you think that we're ever going to get to a place with this therapy where the word psychedelic maybe is something else? It's not psychedelic, because it seems like there's definitely, you know, a lot of people hear psychedelic and they think street drugs, or they go back to the 60s with Bell Bottoms and the Beatles. And I mean, like, do you see any impediment to that particular word being used? And do you think it will ever morph into some other description of this kind of therapy?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a big campaign, but from the, you know, when psychedelics came on board online, and we were at the, you know, in mid, let's say mid to late 60s, we were a very conservative environment. And it really was a catalyst to a lot of social change. We also had a war going on, the Vietnam War, which brought up a lot of, there was a lot of social strife and a lot of transition. And it was scary for a lot of people. It was scary for the government. It seemed like it was unstable. So they went on a campaign to sort of, you know, sort of turn people away from it. And maybe we weren't ready. I guess we were ready for it to some extent, but we weren't really using it. I mean, I don't know if we were mature enough yet for it to be used in the extent that it was at the time. I think it's good that it was used, but we did have to take a step back a little bit. And now it's coming back in. Hopefully we're a little bit more mature in its use, I hope. But the whole idea of the word psychedelic means soul manifesting. So it's that's where it comes from. From my mind manifesting, but really soul manifesting. So seeing things from a more soulful, more holistic point of view. That's what the substance is. It just sort of, it's like I said, the chemical key to the ego, and gives us a greater access to a deeper part of ourselves. So it's nothing crazy. I think it's nothing so wild. It's like, it's no different than meditation. I mean, you know, if you go to a really deep meditation, and there's people who can reach deeper states than what you do using psychedelics without any substance. There's holotropic breath work, just through breath work or through deep, you know, silence. You can have psychedelic type experiences. And what psychedelics is, you just reach, when you quiet the mind, you gain access to a deeper part of ourselves. And that's what the psychedelic is. So I think there's no reason to get rid of it. I think we have to realize what it means.
It's like a bridge, like a facilitator that might take years of other approaches, even like meditation or psychotherapy, to get to that level of depth that you can do potentially in a much shorter amount of time in a gentle and safe way, because it's contained and modulated and you have all these supports in place.
Absolutely. I think, and that's what we use it for. It's not a drug or not an experience or in and of itself. And I always tell people that ketamine is not the treatment. The treatment's yourself, getting back into yourself. It's just a catalyst, a tool that we use to get there. And the same thing with therapy, or same thing with some of the drugs. And people notice after they do these experiences, they go and they continue with their therapist, and they're much more open. Therapy can be very intellectual. And instead of totally in our head, we can actually feel it. We can live it. We can use the tools that we learn in therapy for that. And I think that can be very, very helpful. So to use it as that, as a sort of a catalyst to get into.
Absolutely. Yeah. Love it. Well, I just want to circle back around one other piece that clinically meaningful. I think what I was also wanting to have you clarify is, how do you define that term? Because it sounds like I think I know what it means, or someone reading it might think it. I mean, I think I know what it means, but how do you determine what's clinically meaningful? Like, what's the barometer to measure that, I guess?
Yeah. So some of it is those standardized questionnaires that we hand out.
Okay. So they rate it on like on a scale of 1 to 10 or something.
Like, you know, a score over, you know, with a PHQ 9 over 20 is considered severe, and there's moderate, you know. There is a scale. There's a standardized scale that's been studied. Is it perfect? No, but it is, you know, it's the best we have. You know, in psychology, it's hard to measure these things. And then some of it's through the interviews. So we ask them, like, are you feeling better? Like a very simple thing. How do you feel? And we ask for specific examples. So tell me some examples of how this is helping you in your life and your relationship and whatnot. So we get some of that. So there's some type of more of a subjective dialogue.
Gotcha.
But most of what we use is those scores. And if you look at all the studies, they use these standardized scores. So that's what we're basing it on. But I think it's even better. Some of it, if you go into the nitty-gritty and how it's affecting them, most people notice a quietness and more presence. And I think a lot more people, it's more than 75% even.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I've always got to ask the flip side, just to get a balanced perspective here. Does anybody's symptoms get worse after ketamine in any percentage of the population? Or do they ever develop new phobias that maybe they've never had before after having maybe a not so positive ketamine journey, or even a positive one? Have you ever seen that happen?
I mean, I haven't seen in ketamine. I think we're so controlled. I really haven't seen. I've seen it not work. I've seen people who are very significant. They're just stuck and they don't want, when you come in here, you have to want to let go. This is all about letting go. And some people get very comfortable in where they are.
Yeah.
And in a condition, they feel safe in that. And they don't want to let go. So they leave here. They just sort of nothing happens. They're just, so not blaming. Some people are just, and it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anyone get any worse. I've seen one of the risks, though, is that if someone has an underlying condition like mania, like a bipolar disease, usually they've had symptoms before. So if they're, let's say they've been stable and they've had mania before, it could trigger a manic episode.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's one of the risks. We do go through in the medical, we do a medical, full medical psych and a psychiatric medical intake. So we ask them all these questions. Do you have a family history of bipolar disease? But even in those cases, we would just, if there was, there's ways of treating it we know in advance. So we have to be careful. So we don't want to trigger that. Same thing with psychosis. If someone has a risk of psychosis, schizophrenia, that usually comes on in people in their young, early 20s or so. But if they have family histories, we'd be much more cautious using it in those cases. So that's some of the questions we do. But it's very, 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 very rare that happens. We haven't had anything happen as far as schizophrenia. We have had, with mania, that happened once in someone who was just not properly diagnosed from before, didn't come in, wasn't a very good historian. But they were living in this very depressed, and we use ketamine with bipolar disease. And when they're really stuck in a deep depression and they've been stuck in there, so it helps bring them out of the depression. But sometimes when you bring them out of the depression, they might cycle into this sort of hypomania or manic, which is fine. There we work with their psychiatrist when we know in advance, and there's some medicines we give them either in advance or we give them when they have it, and it brings them right down, and then we get them balanced and they do really well, actually. So we would still use it. We would just be really on top of that.
So anyone who has some kind of real mental health condition really should be coming into a very professional clinic, because there's potential, there's more, I think, higher risk associated with that than potentially someone just trying to, something where they don't have some diagnosis that could potentially open up a can of worms. I mean, I don't know. But yeah, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And I'm just saying to our audience, this is one reason to seek out your clinic or a clinic like yours.
I want to say one other thing about the schizophrenia. So, people, because there's a lot of use outside in the, underground and whatnot. I don't say good. There's some great people doing it underground. We can't, as a medical provider, I can't refer people or tell people to do that, but it is happening. But you have to be very careful, when you're doing it. Number one, the medicines are some interactions. And also, if you've had a history of schizophrenia or psychosis, make sure you don't, you have to be very careful, because it can make that worse. Or if there's a family history, be very careful and be very upfront when you do these things, or if you're going to do them recreationally.
Right.
Just know, it can be dangerous. So,
yeah. Well, more, that's what I was saying. More so because you don't have all the supports and oversight and someone would have if they came into a clinic like yours. So in closing, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you think is really important for our listeners to hear, or anything that you'd like to touch on before we wrap up?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is about sex therapy, about, talking, and it's all about letting go. I think in the end, all about letting go. And I was talking about you think about all the problems that men have, erectile problems.
Yes. Performance challenges or
And or even going to the bathroom, like not being able to pee in a public place. These are all, you know, it all has to do with the parasympathetic nervous system, about letting go, not being on edge. Erections, actually, it's funny because erectile issues, so getting an erection, it has to do with the parasympathetic, the letting go part. Ejaculation is sympathetic. It's about the nervous system. So really letting go is the biggest problem with people have. I have young 20-year-olds. They have a bad experience. They don't feel, or they feel insecure and they can't, you know, perform. And really about getting out of the mind, out of the soul, stop thinking so much and just be more. Meditation could really help. Breath work could help in these situations. But when you're in a relationship and intimate, and also addictions, you know, I see a lot of people come in with sex addiction, porn addictions. It's been normalized. And I don't think that porn is not a benign thing we do.
I totally agree with that.
I'm not saying the thing's good, bad. I'm not in the whole bad or good. Does it serve you? And does DP? And I always ask my, like the men who come in here with that, and they come in here specifically for that issue because they don't feel good. They can't stay in a relationship, not being able to function in a relationship. And I don't think porn, there's a lot of, even like a lot of studies on this. It does wire the brain. And when you, how could you, you know, when you're watching all these porn and you go into your relationship where you've been many years, you can't get excited. So I think withholding, I think being more mindful of that and withholding that, and I think it can really help relationships a lot, and we're seeing that here.
I mean, it's I'm so glad that you looped it back around to that, because I get so excited and I can talk about like so many different angles and topics on this. I love that you looped it back around specifically to some of the sexual challenges that you see people come in with. And yeah, erectile dysfunction, premature ejaculation, and challenges with orgasm, even for female bodied people who are having a challenge, that is all parasympathetic as well. Mm-hmm. We need able to relax, to let go, to surrender. If we're in that where the amygdala is just online, you know, we can't shift into the parasympathetic because we're all in overdrive on the sympathetic side. So the ketamine can really probably be a wonderful tool for that as well, I imagine.
Feeling safe, and safe in our own mind, and then feeling safe with our partner, and then being able to open and go into it with loving. And when there is sensuality, I mean, most men feel horrible. Like they don't, you know, just for the women out there, they have to know that a lot of men don't like it. Like they don't, it's like in the end, they don't feel good.
The porn use you're talking about?
It's like so rampant. That's why I bring it up, because it came up yesterday, actually. So it's on my mind with the patient. He came in here and one of his intentions was to stop using it because he was in a relationship and he wasn't able to perform, you know? And we see more in men, you know, it can be in women too, of course, and in relationships, but, you know, so to bring it back into presence with your partner, I think it's...
Yeah, I love that. I think that's great for a treatment for people who have challenges with the pornography use, because I've seen that be extremely damaging as well. And like just the ways that it can disconnect someone from their body in not a good way, like in the ketamine, I imagine could really help to bring them back into their body so they can start to actually have sensation and feel and just have more of that mind-body connection.
And even the way women are, you know, going online and then social media with women, not feeling good about yourself, not feeling sexy, they go and they compare themselves to these sort of these other people, like these perfectly curated versions. You don't even know with AI that you can like sort of change what you look like now. So you don't even know, you're trying to compare yourself to some virtual, you know, other person. And, you know, women don't feel good about themselves in bed and they can't perform also, you know, you can't let go and enjoy yourself. Yeah. So, you know, you have to be careful, like social media, it's a new experiment. I think it's really infusing itself into our bedrooms and into our relationships, into our, you know,
It's not in my bedroom. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
No technology in my bedroom, no TVs.
Amazing.
Yeah, it has its place, but you're right. And I think at the end of the day, it comes back down to that dopamine imbalance that we can get from too much of the hitting the nervous system with the dopamine. And that we know that social media is something that can do that and cause all kinds of things like depression and anxiety just because of the brain chemical imbalance.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Radowitz, this has been really fun to talk with you. And I want to give you an opportunity just to let our listeners know where they can find you, how they can connect with you. And if there's anything about your center that you want to share, any offerings you want to talk about, or any events you have coming up that you'd like to let our listeners know about.
Yeah, great. So we are located in Midtown Manhattan. The clinic is called Nushama. It's ketamine or wellness, psychedelic wellness center. So we use IV ketamine. And also we offer Spravato, which is for mood disorders. It's put out there by Janssen Pharmaceuticals, and it's covered by insurance. So we do treat all the treatment-resistant mood disorders, addiction, eating disorders. And then if anyone ever wants to come in here, we do have events. You can go to nushama.com, N-U-S-H-A-M-A.com. And we do have events, virtual events at times. Virtually have these integration circles, which is a great place for anyone who, you know, if anyone's never, someone who has never done ketamine before or psychedelics before, to go in and talk to people who have and to get their experience. It's a great place to go. If you ever want to call them, I'm happy to take calls. If you are curious about it, I'm happy to discuss this with people. It's a beautiful treatment. It's safe when used properly and in a responsible manner. And it can really, we're finding it, I mean, it can really change people's lives and get more into themselves. It doesn't change who you are, it makes you more of who you are.
And thank you. I'll put all those resources in the show notes. So anybody listening who wants to connect with you can get those resources there. And I just want to thank you again so much for being my guest today on the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe. Please be sure to show your support by subscribing to this podcast and sharing it with your friends. To keep in the loop on future events and happenings, and to grab your copy of our free ebook, The Pleasure Keys, 7 Secrets to Feminine Sexual Fulfillment, visit us online at pathwaytopleasure.com.